Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, and I'm glad to be with you, this marvelous audience drawn from some of the most reform-minded, original, creative people on Earth. And I have such a person as my guest today. But before getting to her, there is a bit of a sea change going on out there, folks. The New York Times has an article out called Exercising the Mind to Treat Attention Deficits. It's by Daniel Goleman. Daniel, for a long time at the New York Times, was their main science writer until he became a very even more famous writer of books about emotional intelligence. And he's pretty much mainstream science. He's not been known to take on the psychiatrists. But he did, in fact, back in the 80s, come to my aid during a terrible attack on me that I might talk about at some point in the future, which I survived, surmounted, and did better than ever after. And one of the things he talks about in this article is the growing array of old-time doddering experts who have poisoned generations of our children who are now saying it didn't work. The latest is James Swanson. Swanson's been writing about ADHD for decades. He was actually one of the early people to write in some depth about the adverse effects, and so I quote him in some of my early books, maybe going back as far as toxic psychiatry. But Swanson has now come out and said there are no long-term lasting benefits from taking ADHD medications. That's why now he says mindfulness is important, as indeed all alternatives that help children and adults manage themselves and calm themselves are important. Now, this is the second guy now to come around. Connors, who's been a big name in poisoning children for a long, long time, has now decided that maybe it doesn't work. Now, the point is, of course, these guys should have known this when I knew this, which was from the beginning. I mean, how is subduing the behavior of children with Schedule II narcotics going to benefit them in the long run? Makes no sense. The concept of ADHD makes no sense. Using drugs that disrupt multiple neurotransmitters, you know, suppress height and weight, overall growth, limit attention. Really, they limit attention so that the kids will pay attention to very limited things. They cause a psychosis. In the long run, make kids prone to cocaine addiction, and now we're finding from follow-up studies that anything you can measure in an adult's life tends to be worsened by having been diagnosed ADHD and given these drugs in comparison to other controlled children followed over the years. I'm going to be saying more and more about this as time goes on. But let me get to my guest. Marnie, are you there?
Hello, Peter. How are you?
Oh, you sound loud and clear, too.
Good. I hope things hang in here. I've got a thunderstorm going on where I am, so.
Well, if necessary, I'm determined I could talk about children by myself for the whole hour, but I'd much rather talk with you. My guest is Marnie Wedlake. Her last name is spelled W-E-D-L-A-K-E. Marnie describes herself on the internet as a coach and consultant. She's actually a thoroughly educated human being. She got a BA in psychology from the University of Waterloo, which is a good university from what I understand. And she got an MED at the University of Western Ontario, and then her PhD, which is in health professional education. Now, Marnie is she's just a brilliant light, you know, a stunning sound in an otherwise soundless universe in dealing with so many of the issues that I and my listeners hold dearly. I don't even think I need to tell you much about it. I'm just going to hand the mic over for now to Marnie and let her tell you what's near and dear to you, because she kept me speechless on the phone the other day as she talked about it. Marnie, talk about what matters to you right now.
Oh, you know, well, that's a big question, Peter, but there's several hot button issues that I'm really interested. And I'm just going to start by saying one of the things I'm really heartened by is, the groundswell that's coming from, you know, we could call it, you know, not a pejorative way, the ground up movement, where Joe and Josephine Citizen are really speaking out now. And, the internet has really provided for a really nice sort of source of fuel for this groundswell. And so people have access to so much more information than they ever have, and information that is really top-notch information, very thoroughly researched sorts of things, and certainly good critical conversation kinds of materials that are out there. And so people are really well informed now. So what I'm seeing in my work, not only you know, the great, as you mentioned earlier today, you mentioned the increasing body of knowledge that's out there of people who are really questioning the privileged assumptions, and the clinician scholars worldwide who are doing this. But Joe and Josephine Citizen are really well equipped now, and they're coming in droves, and they're saying, you know what? There's better out there, and we know there's better out there, but we're not getting better, and we want better. So don't talk to me about these things that pathologize my adversity in my life, because I want well-being. And really, Peter, that's the crux of my interest right now, is seeing that people don't want to have their differences, their traumas, their adversities, their struggles pathologized anymore. And what they ultimately want is well-being. And that's one of the things that's sort of the way to sum up my overall sort of set of current passions is this whole idea of don't pathologize my adversity and help me to find my way to well-being.
Well, I think it's brilliant. I think it's said really, really well. Dive into talking about your own perspective, the concept of narrative, and how you bring that to bear on just about every aspect of well-being, from living a good life to overcoming psychosis and living a good life.
Yeah, that's one structure. Of my really favorite topics, Peter. Thanks for introducing that. You know, as human beings, we're very, very oriented towards story. You know, and I, as a researcher, my area of research is qualitative research overall, and I'm a narrative researcher, and I really enjoy the notion of story. But as human beings, we make sense and we make meaning through conversation and through story. So if you think about, you know, everything from fairy tales to what we do in our spare time to what we do when we get together with people, really it boils down to we tell stories, and that's how we exchange information. When we get together with people we haven't seen for a while, we tell stories about what we've been up to, and that's how we make sense and we make meaning. We sort of navigate our way through things. You know, you go to a cocktail party somewhere and someone says, what do you do? Well, this is what I do and here's how I do it. That's telling stories, right? So we're very oriented towards narratives, the narrative way as human beings. And when we come back to the larger area of mental health care, our narrative selves are very much present in the world of mental health as well, and that narrative self can become quite compromised, so that our ability to make meaning and to create understanding also becomes very compromised. And so, for instance, how I look at psychosis, if you think about a book, and most books, say you pick up a fiction novel of some sort, let's say it has 10 chapters. I mean, generally most books, it's going to start at chapter 1 and go in a sort of a sequential fashion through to chapter 10, and you sort of go through the book in that way, right? Well, in our narrative self, what I really see when psychosis happens is that narrative self has pulled apart, so that the coherence, or that sort of sequential manner, that overall coherence, I guess, of the narrative self becomes quite disintegrated, you know, so the self is pulled apart and that coherence is gone. And really that's what psychosis is. But, and you would know this certainly in the work you do, Peter, if you sit and you listen to someone who is absolutely right in the middle of a very in-depth state of psychosis, is you can pluck little bits of that meaning out of the air all over the place. They're not necessarily in a really tidy order anymore, but they're still there. You know, and so helping people when they're experiencing psychosis is to dive through those fears and helping them to sort of name in a really non-judgmental, loving way, name some of those bits of their meaning that are still there. They're just not in a tidy fashion anymore. And that's one of the things I love about narrative, the narrative approach to life.
Yeah, that's really well said. Reminds me, in toxic psychiatry, I looked at one of these TV shows that E. Fuller Torrey had done, you know, who believes everything is biological and justifies these antipsychotic drugs. And in the show, they had quotes from the disturbed patients that couldn't possibly make sense. And mm-hmm. I actually quote them in Toxic, and every single mm-hmm. one of them hints at abuse and hints
yep.
at trauma. And
yep.
some of them are describing images of being sexually abused, metaphorically.
Mm-hmm.
But
yep.
to the biological psychiatrist, that's nonsense. But you put it beautifully, you know, the stuff is there. It's just not orderly, and it's
no.
just not presented as coherently and as neatly, because the person's kind of coming apart. I mean, that old metaphor fits. The
yeah.
person is kind of coming apart.
You know, absolutely.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, it reminds me of a metaphor I often use when I'm working with people and sort of, you know, I try as much as I can to help, you know, to sort of, lots of people come and they sort of are aware that, you know, they may have some sense things are really not quite good and they're not well and they're not, things are not right, quote unquote, right. And, but they're sort of beyond that space of easy articulation. So part of my job is to let's get together and try to sort of help to name a few things. And a metaphor I often use is, let's say someone's going to take a boat from New York City to Ireland. And they're about, in Canada we use the term kilometers, so they're about 50 kilometers off the coast of New York City. And the captain, who's really excited about going to Ireland, is tipping back the Irish whiskey, so he's a little bit drunk. And he inadvertently knocks the controls of the boat, so the boat is 2 degrees off course to the south, but he doesn't know it because he's not really aware because of his whiskey drinking. And that boat stays 2 degrees off course to the south. Now, off the coast of New York City, only 50 kilometers, that's not very far off course. But as that boat continues on its journey, it gets further and further off course, so that instead of ending up in Ireland, it might end up somewhere like South Africa. And the person ends up there, and they say, whoa, how did I get here? And I really love that metaphor because it talks about that metaphorical bumping of the controls is really what happens through life, is adversity strikes over and over and over again. It's what we do with it that matters, and what happens, you know, do we get to some sort of a metaphorical, realistic destination that is quite traumatic for us? And lots of people end up in really traumatic places, as you know, where they've gone to that place of primitive fear, where they've lost the ability to engage in dialogue, and they've gone to that place of primitive monologue. And really, that's, you know, and as you say so rightly, is that at the root of most of those situations is big trauma.
Yes, and it's very much like, when the extreme, it's very much like a nightmare, except the person's awake, they're hallucinating terrors that almost
mm-hmm.
always can be related to real-life experiences,
mm-hmm.
or they've got delusions of persecution or delusions of being, you know, superhuman, all of which are easily understandable
mm-hmm.
In the person's life experience and the person's attempts to manage just feeling so terrible about themselves. Now, you work as a coach and consultant with a whole range of folks.
I do, and I have to say, honestly, I use those terms because I haven't come up with a more fitting term at this point. So I do a lot of different work. Really, at the end of the day, what I do is I engage, you know, I build connection with people, establish a relationship, and together we come together to try to look at whether the person has well-being or they don't. And if they don't have well-being, what can we look at together that might be getting in the way of it, and how can we together look at ways they might be able to create well-being. And so if that's coaching, if that's consulting, if that's counseling, if that's psychotherapy, really, it doesn't matter to me. It's what we do that matters. You know, so
well,
I use that title for lack of a better.
Yeah. We didn't talk about this, but I think it's just so important in terms of offering a wide range of services now. And when I talked to you on the phone, it didn't, you know, I didn't think about whether you were a clinician or had a clinical degree. But as I look at it, you don't have a clinical degree, but you've got all this knowledge and you help people, mm-hmm. and you're doing better. I mean, you're more in sync with me than 99 out of 100 people who have the clinical degree. Am I right mm-hmm. about that?
So I guess it depends on how you define a clinical degree. Certainly my undergrad and my master's are. My PhD is more of a research degree because in at least the program I was in, we were trained as researchers. And the work I've done, I mean, I've 28 years working in community mental health care. So I suppose it depends on how you define that.
Okay, so you have been right in the middle of doing therapy within the system then.
You've been in the thick of it, yep.
Oh, okay, good. So I was actually off base on that. But I think it's marvelous that you come from so much educational background, and I'm sure that was part of the process of leaving the abnormal psych background behind.
That was one part for sure. There are lots of parts, but that was one part for sure.
Well, tell us about the evolution, because I love your enthusiasm. I love your approach. Talk about the evolution of your thinking about this, and your professional evolution.
Okay, so way back when, I was always very curious about human behavior, and I can remember as an adolescent being very curious, and always thought I wanted to do a psychology degree, ended up doing that. Like many people, I was one of those people on a boat on my way from New York to Ireland, and the captain bumped the controls on a number of times, and through my own experiences, I ended up being a service user for about 4 years, right in the bowels of the system, and that was, 22 or so years ago. And that was, I refer to that as my apprenticeship, my four-year apprenticeship in the system, because I learned a whole lot sitting on the other side of the desk, and really, sadly, things haven't changed a whole lot since then, I have to tell you. I went back, though, to being a service provider, and after that, I started, probably within 5 years of getting back into the field, started to have some significant questions about what was happening, what I was seeing with regard to how that matched with what was being promised in the sort of the larger realm. I did a master's degree in the mid-90s, and that was quite interesting. Carried on, and I'd always had aspirations to do a PhD, and did that, started that in 2007 and finished it fairly recently. And it was an amazing experience. I worked with some amazing scholars who were are outstanding critical thinkers, and really are all about let's look at things from alternative perspectives. And in that same time, my own sort of questioning about what was going on, and I would see in mental health care, and I was thinking, we can take all these things, but they're just not adding up. And overall, what I'm not seeing is any kind of really significant well-being coming out of this. So a whole pile of things happened. And then, of course, I did a PhD and a research PhD, which meant I was diving deep into massive amounts of content and blown away by what I learned. That I sum it up in a sort of a very tongue-in-cheek way of saying is that I learned that not only does the emperor not have any new clothes, but he's buck naked, Peter.
Now, in the U.S., it's very hard for people to work inside the system. Are you more able to do it in Canada? I mean, your views would just get you chucked from most places that I know of, if not just about everywhere within the establishment. How is it where you are?
Do you know what? I'm really, really fortunate. I'm not going to say where I work. That's just my own thing here. But I work, the organization I work for and I have for a whole lot of years is very, very progressive. I work with some amazing folks. And so, there's a lot of space made for, varied opinions, right? And so, there isn't necessarily right or wrong. It's about making space for varied opinions, and as I need to make space for the opinions of my colleagues as well. So, and at the end of the day, it's about being respectful to our primary stakeholders. But with regard to, employment, and I'm just I've just been very, very fortunate that I work in a very inclusive environment. And certainly my PhD was very much about that. The scholars I worked with were so expansive in their thinking. So there was no silencing of any kind or no sort of oppressive sorts of things in that way. You know, so I've been very fortunate.
Well, are a lot of the people you work with on drugs? Because that can certainly make it difficult.
The clients I work with?
Yeah.
You know what? Unfortunately, yeah, it is. It's very much here in Canada the way it is in the U.S. It's the quick draw with the prescription pad, and you know, and I guess you know at the end of the day, the big issues I have with that. I mean, you know, the science or lack thereof, but it's the messaging and lack of messaging. You know, the messaging that's being given and the messaging that is not being given, and so. So lots of people are choosing medication, but my frustration and my fear is based on the fact that the choices are being made on a lack of content and misrepresentation, and that's really, really frightening, you know. And so, so yes, a lot of clients are on medication. It's very much the way it is in the U.S. here, is that the biomedical model is front and center.
Golly, I find this really interesting, but we haven't talked about it before, and I don't know how much to delve into the kind of issues that come up when you try to work in your setting. Just let me know if it's too much. But I mean,
sure.
Are you free to talk about meds? Because it's such a part of what's going on with the folks, or do you have to kind of just live with that and
I'm limited by my position, so I'm not a pharmacist, I'm not a physician, I'm not a registered nurse, so there's really not much that I can do other than address the concerns that come with me. So I meet my clients where they're at, right? So many people and more people come and they say, don't talk to me about psychiatry and don't talk to me about medication. I want something else. I want well-being, and that's not happening. And so in that sort of a situation, I can say, okay, let's talk about some alternatives here. If you want to talk about alternatives, we can. But if people come and they have specific questions about medication, I would be remiss to get too far into that. I mean, I can help people to get information, but I can't provide consultation or guidance around medication because I'm not medically credentialed in that way, right? What I generally do when I'm doing my work is I will help people to hook up with information. You know, as a health educator, that's my job, is to help people find their way to education so they can make informed choices.
That's what I'm trying to do with my book is The Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. You know, the subtitle is a guide for prescribers, therapists, patients, and their families. Just to encourage therapists wherever they can and counselors to take more responsibility in that area. But it's very high risk. If it pretty much ends most people's careers if they're in an institutional site. Do you have any private patients, Moni?
I do have a private practice. I have a small private practice I've had for about 12 years, yeah.
Now tell us about that and what that's like for you.
So mostly what I do, I provide what I refer to as coaching, as again, for lack of a better title, to people who are told they have adult ADHD. So my job in that realm is not to, again, not to diagnose, not to assess, but to meet them where they are. And generally what I find, most people I end up working with fairly long term, and what I find is that we start to get into, well, what would I refer to it as? I suppose the sort of personal dynamics of daily living, of life in general, of relationships, of where people are in their lives. A lot of my clients come to me; they have significant histories of trauma. You know, I don't tend to be one who gets at all involved in whether you have ADHD, bipolar, or purple stripe syndrome. It's not how I frame my work. You know, so I'm more about what someone experiencing and is it working for them or not.
Tell us what you mean by trauma and what does that cover in your mind? How does it come up in therapy and so on, in counseling or coaching?
So trauma is particular to the person. I mean, there's the obvious ones, right? There's sexual trauma. There's being in abusive relationships. There's tragic deaths, these sorts of things. And then there's the really stealthy ones, the inobvious ones, or the unorthodox trauma, the sort of long-term not so obvious ones. And trauma, is very subjective to the person. You know, of course, that some one individual, for instance, could have horrible, awful, horrific things happen to them, and they could be standing tall. And then someone else could have what someone else might refer to as a bit of a traumatic boo-boo, and they would be completely collapsed by that. And so my role is to sort of is to look at with the person is to help them to name, you know, to not get stuck there, but to name. And if someone if it appears that is has had an impact, then we'll work with that. But it's not about necessarily a particular kind of trauma or a level or intensity of trauma. And quite frankly, Peter, what I often find too is that people who have just had experiences where something has been unrelenting. So say a situation that has not necessarily been really obvious, like a repeated sexual trauma, but lots of the clients I hook up with have had difficulty with relationships. Maybe they've been had some difficult times as children making relationships, and they've been bullied, and they've always felt apart from their peers. And that, you know, experiencing that from a very young age, and then carrying that with them through those early developmental stages into high school, really takes people off course, so that by the time they've come to me, things are really not going well, and we can trace back to that and sort of say, this is, and they will say, you know, people even say to me, well, no, I don't really have any history of trauma. But when we start to talk about it and this stuff comes up, you can see that it's had a really big, quite frankly, a traumatic effect on this person's well-being by the time they get to be adults.
Yeah, very, very much so. I mean, it's really common that, you know, talking about relationships to find that somebody falls in love when they're 13 or 14 or 17 mm-hmm. or 18, and mm-hmm. and it ends with a rejection, and you know, that they're stricken. You know, people
yep.
get really hurt very early. By failed love relationships, their sense of worth gets collapsed.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's worse if they don't have a good, strong, you know, family basis. But either
mm-hmm.
way, early love relationships need to be taken more seriously. Do you mm-hmm. go back much into early childhood?
Do you know, I do very carefully. I do, and my way of working is to sort of look at that as a way of informing, but not to get stuck there, you know, is that, because I really believe we can't change our histories. All we can do is create our futures, you know. We can be present now, and we can create some kind of a futures. We can't change any history. There's no point really in getting stuck there. But sometimes it's good for people to name as a way of helping them reclaim. So if someone has lost a part of their voice, or their overall sense of self is really quite unsteady, or it's not very sturdy in any way, is that going back and looking at some of that and naming and validating and making sense and meaning, and then moving forward, that can be really empowering for people.
We're going to go to break in about a minute or two. What
mm-hmm.
some of the things I'd like to talk with you about in the second hour are the whole idea of qualitative research. In psychiatry, we don't do that because it really has to do with people,
mm-hmm.
and we're much more happy shuffling statistics around. So I
uh-huh.
think it would be really worthwhile to talk to folks about qualitative research, because some of the most informative stuff I read from researchers generally falls in that category. I mean, genuinely informative, you know, helping me understand people and life.
Yeah.
Rather than, say, proving that indeed the SSRI antidepressants do cause suicidality or violence, which one can do statistically,
mm-hmm.
But without telling you much at all about people. So I'd like to mm-hmm. talk about qualitative research when we come back.
Perfect.
And your own particular research, and I'm not sure we talked a lot about that the other day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to hear more about your particular research. And another subject,
sure.
I'd like to talk about what you think the place of relationship is, your personal or professional relationship is with the clients that you're helping in private practice or in the clinic setting. So we can go to break now. As I again welcome my guest, Dr. Marnie Wedlake, just really full of engagement, and I'm going to unleash you some more on the second half of the show. Let's go to break. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin, and don't forget that all the PRN FM shows are archived. Mine usually gets up really pretty quick after the show, thanks to good hard work by Casey. And you can go and listen to it anytime and to any of the other shows here, and you can, you know, push little buttons that say you like what you hear. And that always keeps us in, keeps our morale up, to say the least. My guest, Dr. Marnie Wedlake. Marnie, I want to unleash you a little more to the second half hour. And just have you talk about the things that matter to you. I brought up a bunch of stuff. But I'd really like to just hear you talk more about your way of thinking about helping people. Oh, but also, before I forget, if somebody wants to come see you as a client, a private client, how do they do that?
So they could get in touch with me by email would be the easiest way to do, is get in touch with me by email. All the work actually that I do in my private practice, I do via distance. So I don't ever meet people in person. I do it via telephone. So they would email me, we would set a time to talk.
Well, you can give your email if you like.
Sure. I guess the easiest one to use would be marnie@marniewedlake.com.
How do you find it's working doing? We're going to go off on another me asking you questions here. How do you find it's working to do online or distance help?
You know what? It's great. It's great. I mean, you know, obviously I only know it with the people who I work with because they're the ones I'm working with, right? But I've been doing it for almost 12 years, and it's great.
Well, talk to them about it. I've never talked about this on the air here. If you don't mind, do you mind spending a few minutes talking about your work?
No, not at all. Not at all. No.
Oh, please. Just tell us all about it.
In some ways, for some people, it takes out that, oh, she's looking at me factor, right? You know, eye-to-eye contact.
Absolutely.
And it also, the portability of it works well. And it also expands my geographic area, right? So if there's not a lot of people here who do what I do in Canada. I've had clients all over the country and outside of the country. So it sort of doesn't limit, you know, you don't have to be somewhere, you know, close by within driving distance. So that works fairly well.
And you do traditional hours, or how does it work? Do you Skype?
I don't. I do like a 45-minute sessions. Usually a 45-minute session once a week. And if the wheels come off the bus and somebody's having a rough time, then we'll set something additional up. But I usually do a 45-minute session once a week with people.
So you really have longer-term relationships. You just don't see them firsthand. Is there any reason why you got into doing long distance and so long ago?
It was a model that some American coaches were using, and I thought, well, that's pretty cool because it's convenient for all kinds of reasons for my clients and for me. So I started doing it, and it's worked, so I've kept doing it.
I certainly believe it can work. I don't do long-distance telephone unless I've already established a relationship with a person in my office, but that's just my habit and my choice. I could certainly appreciate what you're doing. I think it's very, very interesting. Do you ever get into crises where you wish that person could just be there in front of you?
Certainly, right? And then we've got to look at finding alternative connections. I need to say, too, though, Peter, that I would never try to do what I do via distance with someone who is really quite seriously unwell. You know, someone who is experiencing a lot of psychosis or really much in the way of psychosis. I just wouldn't. I think that would be problematic for all kinds of reasons. So the clients I work with are and I would sort of screen for this when I start working with a client, is they're really quite able. So there isn't, I think is probably somewhat different than what you're doing.
Yes, but it's the same principle I use. If my client moves away, mm-hmm. I would only work with them on the phone if I felt like that they were sound enough that we weren't going to run into emergencies and have, you know, other difficulties. So basically I use the same principle as you when talking with a client on the telephone. And I only do it a little bit, maybe an hour or two a week. But it's certainly been a part of the way I work for many, many, many years. And I think you're right that some people actually are more comfortable on the phone. I even have clients in my practice who sometimes I'll talk to them on the phone because they can't make it to the session or for some other reason. Yep. And sometimes it's more dynamic and full of vitality because the person feels liberated by not having to worry about me. And I think especially worry about the expressions on my face and so on, which I think especially traumatized people do. They just watch you to see if, like that, you're going to be angry. They got to really keep track of you. And it can be easier on the phone. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, talk some more about just your work in general, the narrative theory, and
it was interesting. On the break, I was thinking, if it's okay, I wanted to share and just have a little bit of a conversation with you about this whole notion of diagnosis. You know, there's a real a bit of a rebellion going on right now, and that's maybe a bit of an understatement with regard to the, I think the release of DSM-5 has brought that out, is people are saying, you're kidding, is everything going to be a diagnosis? And that's an area of interest of mine is the notion of the narrative self and what happens to the narrative self when the diagnosis is applied to that person.
Go ahead and talk some more about it.
There's a really great medical sociologist named Arthur Frank, and he does a lot of qualitative work. And he has an interesting quote that goes something to this effect: is that the person becomes the patient when the diagnostic category is attached to his or her name, and it's something to that effect. It's not an exact quote, but I just spoke with a family about this today, actually, in my work, and the notion of diagnosis. It tends to be some people embrace a diagnosis, and others are really resistant to diagnoses. But overall, and when I looked at the literature in my PhD, I looked at this through a critical lens, and I have to say I'm not able to find any reason why should be much emphasis on this notion of applying a diagnosis to someone, given the very subjective nature of it. And and really what I sort of came up with in the research that I did is that I can't see that we could take something like bipolar 1, schizoaffective disorder, and schizophrenia and say, here's where bipolar 1 ends, here's where schizophrenia begins, and here's where schizoaffective fits into this. And it's very clear, and et cetera, et cetera. I just can't see that we can take these experiences and arbitrarily configure them into these diagnostic categories and have that be of some value. But beyond that, what I started to look at was this notion of where does experience fit into that, so this idea of the narrative self. And so what I ended up deciding, it worked for me in terms of framework, is that diagnosis is not a language set or a discourse that makes any sense to me, is that diagnosis to me is very much outside of the person. It is not of the person. Whereas experience is of the person. And by experience, Peter, what I mean is things like psychosis, like despair, angst, fear, sadness. These are experiences. we could take those experiences and we could call them symptoms, and we could configure them in various sorts of recipes and say, well, this configuration in this way is bipolar 1, this configuration in this way is post-traumatic stress disorder and such. And to me, that felt very, very arbitrary. And when I started going through the research, I really couldn't find any reason to see it other than something that was a random subjectivity that was applied to a person. And then what it ends up doing, I think, is that it separates the person from his or her experiences, and those experiences being things like the despair, the sadness, the angst, the fear. And so that became really, really problematic for me. Then beyond that, I was looking at the notion of, is how do we get to well-being? Is diagnosis a path to well-being? And several things came to me in that, is that a diagnosis can intrude on the person's ability to be accountable and responsible. And not only for things like behavior and, you know, the sort of various things of daily living, but also for well-being. That if I don't have well-being, my question to myself needs to be, why don't I have well-being, and what's my role in not having well-being? And if I want well-being, then my question to myself needs to be, how am I going to have well-being? What am I going to do? Whose help am I going to enlist to help me get to well-being? If my experiences are part of me, it's going to be much more, I think, effective and efficient for me to do that rather than if I sort of become outside of myself because I become a diagnosis. So if I am bipolar or I am schizoaffective, that's what I am. If I have psychosis or I have sadness, then that's still within inside of me. I'm not pulled apart so much, and I'm not outside of myself. So I think that accountability, responsibility, but also a sense of agency. You know, that thing that all of us need to be, you know, to fully actualize, is that sense that I can make positive change in my life and I can take myself to a place of well-being. Much more possible if we work with experience than if we say to someone, here's your assignment, your diagnosis, and it is outside of yourself. Because that diagnosis then says, here's what can and cannot happen to you. See that train of thought?
Oh, absolutely. And of course, it's complicated by the fact that the entire pharmaceutical industry now lives on diagnoses, where physicians and other practitioners give diagnoses justifying drugs. So that's another dreadful part about it. When patients ask me, or my clients ask me for a diagnosis or what I think about diagnosis, you know, I say, look, it's about your life, and probably 10 people could write your biography and they'd all see something different. I'm not going to try to, to play pin the tail on the donkey and give you a diagnosis. It just isn't what it's about. It's about your life. Let's understand your life. I don't use the term narrative so much because I just wasn't exposed a lot to that, but I think of it as biography and autobiography. You know, you're writing your autobiography, mm-hmm. your whole life, and love to help you make it come out as well as it can. I think it's just mm-hmm. so similar to how you're thinking. It's just two people, you and me, talking about the same thing, in different directions.
Sounds like
I think it's incredibly important for people not to feel that they are alien, that they are different, that what afflicts them isn't just a part of being a human being, and that if they're particularly disturbed, it isn't because there's particularly something wrong with them. It's almost certainly because they've been through particularly distressing experiences.
Mm-hmm.
That this whole idea of people having something wrong with them, it's quite destructive to them, allows them to then succumb to all kinds of manipulations and abuse. So I like to get away from the whole idea that you've got something wrong with you. I mean, if you're in my office and you're experiencing a psychotic episode, you know, and I know you well, I'm probably thinking you're doing better than I would under the same things that you've been through. And, mm-hmm. And that, again, there's nothing wrong with you. You're just struggling with some incredible problems, which you're having some, you know, very frightening and distressing effects on you. Mm-hmm. And the more Absolutely. I can talk that way, the more comfortable and, I think, empowered people are.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely, and I like that word empowered, you know, and I think that that was something else that I've noticed in the literature and certainly in my professional experience is that, that when we talk about experience and that we talk about it from a place of ownership, is that that has an empowering connotation to it. But when we talk about diagnosis, it tends to be more disempowering, you know, and that's something that I've noticed as well.
You talk a lot about research as we're talking, and I suspect a lot of the research is qualitative rather than quantitative. Tell the audience, a lot of folks may not know much about this. What is qualitative research?
So qualitative versus quantitative. So qualitative is how do I sum that up really quickly? Geez, I hope none of my professors are going to be listening to me here so that I don't mess this up.
You know, it's not a really test, so you don't have to sum it up. Just sort of give your ideas about it.
So it's more about capturing snapshots of experience. You know, so it's not about truth. So we don't use, there's certain language we don't use. I can tell you what it is not. So we don't try to validate things. We don't try to show things that are reliable and validated and proof. We're not about proof. We're not about truth. We're not about, we're not about creating the gospels. It's really about taking snapshots of experience and putting them out there as a way of informing. No, so qualitative research is very much about that. There's not the same, and within qualitative research too, biases are embraced because biases are part and parcel. And really, if we really unpack it, Peter, biases are absolutely front and center in quantitative research as well. They're just not willing to admit it. You know, but qualitative research is very much about acknowledging the biases and is acknowledging that we're not trying to prove. It's acknowledging that what we're trying to do is show a snapshot of experience.
Well, I think all that's very helpful. Some of the most valuable research that I have is on my website, the ECT resources mm-hmm. website, and it's mostly by women, and mm-hmm. many of them are sociologists, psychologists, feminists, describing the woman's experience of ECT and the family experience of ECT
mm-hmm.
and the husband's attitudes toward ECT.
Yep.
It's incredibly enlightening, and also research that's looked at the experience of people on antipsychotic drugs. You know, what do they say? How do they feel? How mm-hmm. do they describe themselves? And clearly the people who are looking, and I hadn't thought about this until you you made it a part of the idea itself of qualitative research, people are acknowledging that they are looking for certain, you know, kinds of things that other people aren't looking for, whereas the qualitative research is almost all driven by pharmaceutical industry money, psychiatric authority, trying to prove things work. You can't even get an article published, mostly, if you haven't shown the drug works. They don't want that published. So their biases are there, just as you say. But the biases of qualitative research seem to be about the subjective experience of the person and its value. Mm-hmm. Is that one fair way to put it?
Oh, absolutely. And they're really on the biases, there's generally not much judgment on the biases because they're just acknowledged that they exist and that's part of the experience, is that our experiences are informed by sort of our dialogic selves, you know. So there's a Russian philosopher who I really like. His name was Mikhail Bakhtin, and one of his areas of philosophy was that of dialogism, and that was looking at the various factors of influence that come together and inform how we see the world and how we are in the world. And when you think about it, when we interact as people, and certainly our clients who have landed in some kind of a situation where things are not going well for them at all, what are the factors of influence that have contributed to the some kind of a collapse or some kind of you know, dis-ability or dis-order, you know, being important distinction there. And really it's those factors of influence that matter, that shape how we are in the world, who we are in the world, and how we interact. And really those factors then go to the next interaction we have, and they shape that interaction. And so it's that you know, I'll tell two friends, you tell two friends, and before you know it, we'll all know, kind of thing. You know, it's the global conversation is very dialogic, and it's very much about acknowledging that in all of our interactions, we shape our contributions according to those experiences that have shaped us.
Can you give an example of maybe one of your favorite research pieces that you've done or somebody else has done that's qualitative research that you think is influential or important?
Oh, boy, there's gazillions and gazillions and gazillions of them.
How about one of your own?
Okay, so my dissertation is I have not done any publishing of it yet, but I have done a lot of looked at a lot of work. I look a lot at the nature of the self and experience. I look a lot at the notion of the authorial voice. You know, so am I the primary author of my own story? And one of the things I find in mental health care is that when various biomedical subjectivities are applied to a person, his or her position of authorship gets kind of pushed down the line, so they're not necessarily their own primary author of their own story. So this is another thing that diagnosis can do, is it can disrupt that person's ability to author his or her own story, because sometimes for a lot of people, although they may feel that they get some relief by having a diagnosis, that relief comes at a cost, and that cost is that diagnosis can become a primary author of somebody's story. And so that approach to qualitative research I really like. I mean, if I look at the work of Arthur Frank, medical sociologist out of UCalgary, I think, originally from the U.S., he has great qualitative research, and in fact, he has a book called The Wounded Storyteller. That's a bit of an older book, but it's a classic and a great look at the narrative self and looking at illness experiences through a qualitative lens.
So, in your research, did you spend a lot of time just asking people to talk to you and to talk to you about specific ideas? How'd you go about it?
So my research for my PhD dissertation was autobiographical narrative. So I was my lone participant. So that's another thing about qualitative research is we're not concerned about the N, you know, how many we have. In quantitative research where they're using statistics, in order to get a valid statistic, what is a thought to be valid, you have to have certain number of participants, you know, the power N equals, you know, 475 in this randomized control trial, otherwise it's not valid. Quantitative research, we're not concerned with that. We are about capturing snapshots of experience. So you could have two people, you could have 10 people. In fact, most qualitative research studies have very few participants. Some might have none. It might be a philosophical analysis. A theoretical analysis. Others might have two participants, one participant if it's an autobiographical study, maybe six, because it's about the richness of the experience and the sort of often the philosophical foundation that informs that research and that approach, analyzing those experiences.
You know, most people wouldn't realize that decades ago, medicine was mm-hmm. much more about this kind of research. Mm-hmm. So that when you go back and you read, as I have, early studies on mm-hmm. encephalitis, for example, because I mm-hmm. was comparing the effects of antipsychotic drugs in one of my papers to an encephalitis epidemic, which caused many similar effects. And you go back and you read, and there'd be pages of description of the patient's experience. Mm-hmm. And the patient's various, in this case, physical symptoms and mental symptoms, mm-hmm. so that another person could actually go and, like myself, and decades later, read these reports and get our own understanding and our own viewpoint, do our own analysis. Whereas, and even in psychiatry, quite often there were lengthy case studies in the older literature where you'd really get a sense, at least from the clinician's viewpoint, what the individual was going through and what they were like. You don't see this anymore now. It's interesting to think about what happens with so-called objective research is the person focuses on something that's going to further their agenda, like mm-hmm. how few symptoms they can find in their patients after lobotomy, or mm-hmm. how few symptoms they can find in their patients after the latest drug. It's literally how many adverse effects, the fewest adverse effects. And they go and they actually model the research, which then becomes a bunch of numbers around a few limited observations. It makes the research incredibly narrow and relatively useless mm-hmm. for anything other than advancing a biological pharmaceutical cause.
It's
a little abstract.
It's so true what you're saying, Peter. You know, it reminds me, I talked to a family this week, and their son, who has a psychotic disorder, was introduced to a new psychiatrist. This psychiatrist saw this young man for, you know, they said probably 15 or 20 minutes once, and then the second appointment was about 5 minutes, and that was all that was required, apparently, to get this young man sorted out with medication and et cetera, et cetera. As it turns out, the young man doesn't want to see this doctor. But how does something like that make space for someone's story that doesn't? You know, that doesn't, and it's a tragedy.
It excludes the human being entirely. We're coming down to the end. Do you have a 20-second parting words?
You know what I do, and I have on my personal email address, I have my own tagline that I use, and this is so meaningful to me, and maybe it is to some of your listeners, is well-being is not prescribed. It is created with ownership and intention. And well-being is there for all of us. Even if we need some help to create it, it is there.
Dr. Marnie Wedlake, Wedlake. You can Google her with ease. A delightful, enlightening guest. Marnie, thanks for being on the show.